Hello, it's Robert Bathurst here. I was one of the first guests on My Time Capsule, and Mike has asked me to tell you that you can now listen to the podcast ad-free by subscribing to Acast Plus. Details of how to join are in the description of each episode. Mike says it's very reasonably priced. In fact, Mike says it's a bargain. And who am I to disagree, locked here in his cellar? Anyway, for a small subscription, Acast Plus, My Time Capsule, ad-free. Free. Unlike me.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Hello, and welcome to another episode of My Time Capsule. I'm Mike Fenton-Stevens, and in this podcast, I ask my guests to tell me the five things from their life that they would like to put in a time capsule, four things they cherish and wish to preserve, and one they'd like to bury and never have to think about again. My guest today is the writer and stand-up comedian Ahir Shah. Ahir has been doing stand-up since he was 15, when he first started doing open mic shows. He soon established himself on the circuit and continued to perform through school and his time at Cambridge University, where he studied politics, psychology, and sociology. Since then, he has very successfully toured his own shows all over the world. He performs on and writes for the BBC Two satirical news show, The MASH Report, and is a popular guest on various panel shows, including Have I Got News For You, Frankie Boyle's New World Order, and Radio 4's The News Quiz, and Explicable Me. You may also have seen him on Live at the Apollo. So, let's find out the five things that Ahir wants to put in a time capsule. And plenty of other things, including the lesson for all you budding podcast makers out there to remember to put the microphone as close to yourself as your guest. You'll see, well, in fact, you'll hear what I mean. Still, enjoy the podcast.
Lovely, Ahir.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being part of My Time Capsule.
Not at all.
In fact, it's your time capsule.
Yeah.
So, yes, we were talking just before we started this, we were talking about your extraordinary move from being a comprehensive school boy in Watford to
Southern Wembley.
In Wembley.
The other W. The other Northern W.
Yeah, in
North Village. Of London.
So you were there.
So on the mean streets of Wimbledon.
And then suddenly Cambridge.
Yeah.
Doing politics.
Yeah, not many people from Wrexham did end up in that situation.
Which is maybe a terrible insight into the state of British education, that not many people end up making that jump.
Yeah, I suppose it's mainly, I think, just what you actively believe is open to you when you're at that formative stage of mid-teens or whatever. Like, I still remember being 14, 15 and stood outside a particular classroom at Preston Manor, and some of my friends gently ribbing me about Ahir's probably going to go Oxford or something like that. And I just said, no, that's for rich white people. And thankfully I then it was largely the influence of my parents and two teachers who were very influential and like, no, you should go down that path, and we think that that holds something for you. And yeah, I'm thankful that I didn't listen to 15-year-old me.
Yeah. How extraordinary how often that teachers can be that influential in your life, completely change the direction of where you're going.
Oh, absolutely. And like, I know that from the fact that my mother is retired now, but she was a primary school teacher for her career. And still in the local area, like one of my favourite things to tell people about her is that she has been on several occasions walking down the high road in the local area and had a person in their 20s or 30s pushing a pram, and the mother or father saying to the child in the pram, "That's Mrs. Shah, that's who taught me how to read." And like, to remember that positive influence from someone from when you were 5 years old is such a remarkable thing. And just says, yeah, like the sheer amount of power that she had in shaping these lives at such a crucial stage. And thank God she was good at her job. Otherwise,
yeah, I know.
God knows how many people she could have screwed over the course of the decades.
I think there are teachers who screw
people.
Definitely ones at my school.
Well, I always found it interesting. My because I went to the primary school that my mother taught at, and she never wanted me to be in her class, but she was always, like, before I went up to the next year, she would say, "Oh, can I here go in X's class for year two and Y's class for year three?" I was like, I always thought that it must have been very offensive to the teachers that she didn't choose. I was like, what's wrong with me?
I don't want you teaching my son.
Yeah, why is Joanne so much better than me?
That's terrible. They suddenly feel like complete failures.
Yeah.
Damn, I didn't get out here.
Yeah, whereas the ones who did are just walking around Wembley strutting.
Yeah. Oh, dear. So when did you go to Cambridge? How long ago was that?
That was quite a while ago now. It was I matriculated in 2009 and left in 2012.
Ah, right. Yeah.
So, yeah, sufficiently like another life now.
And you were doing stand-up right the way through.
Yeah, well, that was part of the...
Pay the fees.
Part of the reason that I wanted to go there was that I knew that the Footlights existed as a thing and was interested in taking part in something with other young people who were obsessed about the same thing that I was obsessed with.
Mm, comedy.
Yes, exactly.
It can become a complete obsession, can't it?
It is, and it's just like the most valuable thing is just to be stuck in a room with people who are nerds about the same thing that you're a nerd about.
Yeah.
Is always going to be astonishingly valuable.
Yes, I remember the same feeling myself. I think of suddenly finding people who were like-minded.
Yeah.
Who got the jokes that you were making, in fact. Often people around you, they look at you with a blank expression, thinking, what are you talking about? You think it was a joke.
Oh, is there a point where that stops happening?
That's your audience.
I've been in this game a while.
I think you'll find the hardest crowd will be television executives. Okay, so we have this time capsule that you're going to put five items into.
Yeah.
So let's work our way through it and see what you've got. What have you got for your first item?
Well, I wanted to check before beginning that I'm not consigning these things away. Like, they still get to exist in the world because some of them are things that I actually enjoy in the world and still experience.
Yes.
And so I don't want them to be, you know, buried under a community centre for the next century.
No, but they're protected.
Okay, protected. Okay, that's good. That's good. In which case, the thing that I will open with is the very specific smell of a Gujarati kitchen and specifically my mother's kitchen, where it's generally starts off, regardless of what you're making, with heated oil, whole spice, regardless of which will differ depending on what you're making. So be it cumin or methi or mustard seeds or anything like that. Then you'll have some ground asafoetida, some ground turmeric, put everything into it. Towards the end, you'll be adding coriander and cumin powder and a resham pati, a chili powder. And that smell for me is just so evocative of home. And the things that, like, now that I cook that sort of food, now that I'm out of the family home and a bit older, I remember growing up, my mother was always very keen on all of the windows being open while she was doing that, because she's like, oh, no, I don't want to get cooking smells in the clothes. I don't want to get cooking. Whereas I'm the absolute opposite. Oh, like, I don't use the extractor fan specifically because I want to smell of curry, really. And weirdly, it's only since I've got in my 20s that I realized what that generational shift was, where undoubtedly for in my mother's generation, the fact that you would have that smell on you from the cooking of the family home was a marker of difference, and a marker of difference that you may feel shame as a result of, or maybe made to feel shame as a result of. Whereas now, it's obviously still a marker of difference, although less so than it was when my mother came here in the early 1970s. But it's a marker of difference which I'm very much proud of, that I know this is like A, delicious, B, I'm carrying forward a culinary tradition that was taught to me by my mother and everything. So I think that that's a whole thing of the immigrant experience and the difference between the first generation and second generation immigrant experience, and the maintenance of a culture and being part of two cultures and everything, for me and my family is all encapsulated in that single thing of asafoetida hitting a pan.
You know? Oh, yes. So have you spent much time in India?
Not as much as I'd like. I've been over a few times. The last time that I was there was in the winter of 2017, where I did a stand-up tour of a bunch of Indian cities, and then at the end went to see... Because my father's side of the family are basically all in Gujarat, in Ahmedabad specifically. So I spent time with them there. But the reason that I would spend time with her was largely because my paternal grandmother, who we will talk about later, she lived in the UK with us until I was five when she was deported, and was very much sort of second mother to me. So I was just obsessed with her. And like in that sort of... Because when someone's taken away from you like that, you get locked in a specific point of time in that relationship. So I would always feel like a five-year-old boy when I was with her.
Yeah.
So the last time that I was there was, so I was, you know, 26 the last time that I was there, but that was when she was coming to the end of her life, and she's passed away now. So there's less reason now in some way.
So why was your grandmother deported?
So basically, I have inherited two things from my grandmother, or have two consequences of her life that I carry with me throughout my life, which are A, excellent hair, and B, a deep-seated and abiding hatred of the Conservative Party. It's basically changes in immigration rules that were brought in by the major government that led to... So, like, regardless of any... You know, and we all have the conventional sort of, like, drift rightwards, the older that we get and everything, and I think of, like, me 10 years ago as, I suppose, like, far left, and now I'm centre left and everything. But anytime I read a policy that I'm like that the Conservatives are doing, I'm like, oh, maybe that's not so bad. I'm like, no, they stole your nan. They did not. So the reason behind her having to go was she moved to the UK when she'd been widowed, just on the understanding that my father, as her eldest child, would be the best placed person to look after her in that situation. And then that worked out brilliantly for the first 5 years of my life. And then these changes came about, and it meant that because she had another son in India, and, you know, she was at the time in her mid-60s, and I'm like, look, you're probably only going one way in terms of the relationship between what you're paying into the state and what you're getting back from the state, and everything's
so done
in a rather cold, calculating way, which was particularly cold and calculating when you realise that my uncle is estranged from the rest of the family, and the last time he saw his own mother was when he told her that the next time he saw her would be at her funeral.
Oh, no.
And that's who the government were like, go live with that lad, that'll work out fine.
Just because he's abroad.
Yeah.
He doesn't live here.
Yeah, exactly.
Thanks a lot. It's extraordinary, isn't it? So when you go to India, do you feel at home there, or do you feel just British?
You do become slightly... Like, I'm hesitant to say this because of Mrs. May's thing of, like, if you're a citizen of the world, you're a citizen of nowhere, which I feel as though... The subtext when she said it, I vastly disagree with, but that as a general statement, I think there is actually something to, because you can end up, despite the fact that I was born in Britain and have lived here my whole life, there is something where you feel slightly placeless, I think, occasionally, if you're visibly second generation, as I am. So, for example, I remember the last time I was in India, I was in a pub in Bangalore, and I just was stood there just having a conversation with all of these people, and I was like, something about this feels weird. What feels strange about this? I can't quite put my head around it. So it took a minute just to think about it. And I realized that it was the first time that I'd ever been in a bar where I wasn't visibly different to everyone, right? Like, that everyone there was also there. And actually, when we were talking and the jokes that were being cracked at me was that, oh, I'm the outsider because I'm the English guy. Right, so it's odd, like, here, there's always a bit in, like, certain spaces, and certain, like, I will always be consciously or subconsciously the Indian guy,
yeah.
And over there, I'm always consciously or subconsciously the English guy. So, where I don't know where my place is. It's geographically, my place is probably around St. Petersburg or something, or whatever's halfway between.
That's very unfair.
But that's when you hyphenate, right? Like, I'm entirely comfortable with saying I'm British Indian, and yeah. That to me means something slightly different to British and slightly different to Indian.
And of course, the experience of being British Indian today is very different to the experience your parents would have had coming here in the 70s.
Oh yeah, they didn't have a Chancellor of the Exchequer, baby. Finally in control of the purse strings. I just need to figure out that Rishi Bhai is actually a sleeper agent and his first budget will include the repatriation of the Kohinoor.
Oh, Lord, don't say it.
No, what it's probably going to include is more tax relief for people who don't need it. That's the way of it, unfortunately. Yes.
There's not much you can do about that, I'm afraid.
I realise.
Apart from, I don't know, a vote or assassination. One or the other.
I would like to make it clear that both Michael and I advocate the former,
yes.
And not the latter. Not the latter, very important.
I'm putting my gun down now.
I just remembered listening to the budget when Mr. Hammond was delivering it a few years back, and I was in Brussels just walking around, like, listening to it on headphones, and I realised that for the first time in my life, things in a Conservative budget were going to actively benefit me, and it was because I was no longer a properly young person, and I was earning a certain amount and everything. I'm like, oh, God, things have really changed, actually. Like, this is...
It's a difficult thing, isn't it, when you realise that you're constantly voting against your own interests?
Yeah, well, this is also why, you know, I get quite annoyed when people discuss the fact that, you know, so many people who voted to leave the European Union were voting against their own self-interest. And you're like, yes, if self-interest is narrowly defined in economic terms, then yeah. A lot of people have voted against their self-interest, but I often vote against my economic self-interest because we all have sort of overlapping circles of self-interest because none of ourselves are reducible to anything. And that's why it becomes so frustrating when people on the left play this game, particularly in relation to the European Union, where you're like, right, you realise that what you're doing here is essentially trying to make us all into Homo economicus, the rational agent, is just reducible to the
and
things
in our pocket. And you're going to lose all us, we'll all
vote Tory. It's multiple layers of interest. Like, my mother's first general election that she would have been able to vote in was the first election where Mrs. Thatcher came in 79. And before then, my late grandfather, who was the prototypical, like, small-C conservative, as many people from that generation and culture were, you know, like, family values, entrepreneurial, hard work gets you somewhere, don't want to rely on anyone else for anything. Law and order, yeah. But he never voted for the Conservative Party, and he said to my mother before her first general election, which has always stuck with me since my mum told me, he said, I will never tell you how to vote, but the one thing that I would say is that I would suggest not voting for the Conservative Party because the Conservative Party don't care about people like us. And that has remained true for me of the kinds of us that I particularly care about being. Mm-hmm. And the kind of us that I care about being is not the kind that is particularly concerned with the personal impact of marginal tax rates on...
quite. I think you're wise. That's my personal opinion. So I love the idea of this kitchen smelling of Gujarati food.
Yeah, and then it means that someone, when they open up the time capsule, they'll get the hit of that.
They'll go, where's that? Where's that?
Yeah,
it's right down the bottom with first thing we put in.
Yeah.
You're going to have to dig deep. You're going to have to dig through all my other things before you find it.
Yeah.
Oh, lovely. Yeah, so in fact, also, everything else is imbued with this smell.
Mm.
So that leads us on to our second curry-smelling item.
Yeah. Well, this one, I'm going to stick with food on this one, because this also encapsulates a sort of experience of being on a holiday and stuff like that as well. But I was in Mexico City in December of 2018, and I was just walking around with my then-girlfriend, and I was super, super hungry. She wasn't. And there was just like, in Mexico City, it's just dotted with these little food stalls on every street corner. Mm. I was like, oh, I'll just pop in there and get something quick. And I don't speak Spanish. She does speak Spanish. And there was nothing that looked vegetarian on there. But she just explained to the guy that I didn't eat meat and was there anything that they could do. And they're like, oh, yeah, we'll knock something up. And it was extraordinarily simple. It was just like a blue corn tortilla that they made into a quesadilla with queso and some potatoes and some other stuff, like some spices and things. But I just remember sitting there and eating the first one of these and then being like, do you mind if I get... And I would just keep like finishing one and going and getting another, because it was unbelievably delicious, but also like I felt bottomless at that. And there was something like just this really intensely pleasant feeling of being on a street corner in the sunshine with someone I love, drinking Coca-Cola and trying to fill an absolute crater in me that I didn't know had previously existed, because this thing was just so goddamn delicious. And yeah, I was just very happy in that moment. So
I've eaten very little Mexican food, so it's not an experience I share. Quite often, people find it difficult to adapt to other forms of food.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I always find if I go to Germany, I just think, so much meat.
So much
sort of cured meat as well. I can't...
Well, I've also found... sort of Eastern Europe in particular, when I've travelled there, I've found quite difficult as a vegetarian.
Where there are many countries where it's difficult to be a vegetarian, even today. Yes.
Yeah.
My daughter was a vegetarian for many years. She isn't anymore, strangely. But that was due to pregnancy.
She ate meat again when she was pregnant. Okay.
She was advised by her doctor that she needed to eat meat to get the certain vitamins and stuff in there.
Yeah.
I don't know if it's true, but it worked.
Yeah. Well, I take a vitamin B12 supplement every day. My mother gets like 6 monthly injections of vitamin B, which is like obviously the thing that we're missing out on by being vegetarian. Well, not necessarily missing out on, but it's like with being a vegan. Like, I think that the reason that I would struggle to be a vegan is that you've got to put a hell of a lot of thought into things to make sure that you're getting everything that you actually need.
Yes.
I've had one of the interesting things about... basically, every culturally specific diet historically has ended up being perfectly balanced just because it's what the human body needs and what, through thousands of years, people have come to realize we should have this together. So with Gujarati food, for example... also, we're basically just turning this into a food podcast, and I'm entirely fine with it. Yeah, yeah.
I'm starving.
With Gujarati food, because it's vegetarian or vegetable-based... then there's always, well, everything's got, we'll have a little dal with it, because there'll be lentils, and that's where you're getting your protein from, and everything's balanced. But now that we live in a world where I will be having, you know, Swiss muesli for my breakfast and something Italian for my lunch and something Gujarati for dinner or what have you, and constantly like rushing around and picking stuff up. And I'm very glad that we live in a country and a world where that's possible.
Mm.
But got to keep up those supplements.
Yes, it's true.
I stopped eating meat when I was a child because, like, I gather that there's a thing that oftentimes when children discover what meat is for the first time and discover its relationship to animals, obviously children all like animals, so I have heard that oftentimes young children, when they first make that connection, will say, oh no, I don't want that because that's animals. Mm. And I did that, and then I just continued.
Yes. I think that's exactly why my daughter became a vegetarian, because she made that connection and thought, well, that's horrible. Do you think that the world will eventually go completely that way? Because economically and environmentally, it seems to make sense.
I think it'll be lab-grown. I think that, and like, I would have absolutely no problem with eating a lab-grown beef burger or something like that.
Right.
Largely just out of the interest of it.
Yeah.
I know largely now there's environmental reasons behind it and stuff. But, you know, like, I was very fortunate in that being a vegetarian for me was incredibly easy, because I grew up in a culinary tradition where everything was largely based around vegetables anyway. Mm. And so the only time that my family would ever have chicken was basically like once a week as a treat or something like that, because largely it was the only thing my dad knew how to make. So that time, you know, he would do that. And then very frustratingly, my mother would still have to make something for me. So she wasn't even getting the night off, unfortunately. it always strikes me as odd that, in terms of climate change, probably the main reasons we are not all currently underwater is that Hindus don't eat beef and China instituted a one-child policy. the second of those things is quite beastly. I'm so committed that, like, there's a milk bottle here in front of us, and like when that's done, I'm definitely going to be like studiously recycling it.
Yes,
all.
And everything.
And it's just like, no, there's 1.5 billion people of whom most won't eat cows, which are farting us to death. That's what's doing.
Yes. I always use that argument whenever my wife tells me off for putting something that can be recycled into the waste bin, because I'm sure it does help, but I can see that it's a tiny percentage.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely. But I think that, you know, as with so many things in life, they're just minor psychological balms for ourselves. But who's to say that that isn't valuable? You know, like, in the same way that the antidepressant that I take daily may well, it could be a placebo for all I know.
Yeah.
But the fact of feeling like I'm doing something that to make myself better makes me feel better.
Yes.
And that's probably the same thing as when I studiously wash out the bean tin and I'm like, I'm doing my bit. Mm. And don't I get to sleep slightly easier tonight?
Yes. And have you suffered from depression in the past?
Oh, yeah, yeah. As I say on stage, in my early 20s, I was diagnosed as being clinically totes emotion. So that's my situation.
Well, we won't dwell on it.
I do enough dwelling on it.
We should sit outside in Mexico.
The feeling of bottomlessness and love and sunshine and Mexico goes in.
Yes, it goes in, definitely.
Yeah.
So where are we? That's two?
That's two, and we're on number three now.
We're going to take a short break here to entertain you with some adverts. We'll be back very shortly.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads, generally, for most people, are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Welcome back. Right, let's get back to Ahir Shah and discover what else you would like to put in the time capsule.
We're now mercifully moving away from the world of food. So if you've been interested up to this point, this may be the time to switch off and go listen to Off Menu or something like that.
get a pudding.
Yeah. But the third thing that I would like to put in, because it's something that I love and wish I could share with people who don't do stand-up, there is a point in stand-up, which doesn't happen every time, but the feeling that you get when there's a full room who are really going, and everything's just right, and you can afford yourself almost a second out of your, because you want to remain in the moment and remain in the room, because that's what makes, when it's properly singing, that's what makes it sing. But you almost allow yourself a half second out of it, and you feel as though you're conducting an orchestra, right? And you deliver a line there, and you're like, and this is when, and violins, come on, and then, and let's get the timpani coming from over there, and feeling that, and feeling the waves and crescendo and diminuendo and everything of doing that. I'm even doing the thing with my hands now as I describe it. But yes, that feeling of when everything is just so, and it's all working in perfect concert. Yeah. That's something that I would very much like to preserve.
Oh, it's a marvellous feeling. Anybody who's done comedy understands that feeling. Mm. And the strange thing that I always feel about it is that at that moment, it feels as if, for you, time is moving at a different speed to everybody else.
Yeah, the closest analogy that I've been able to come up with is when people talk about really good footballers and they say, it looks like he's got so much time on the ball. Mm-hmm. I was like, obviously he doesn't. Obviously time is moving at the same speed for everyone. But when you watch Messi, it doesn't feel like time is moving at the same time as everyone. And you're like, when they say in cricket, like, oh, he's seeing it like a beach ball or something like that. Like, and this, a rock is being thrown at you at 90 miles an hour. And yet, if you're Sachin Tendulkar in his prime, it must just look as though someone's throwing you a little underarm that you can whack with your bat that happens to be the size of a shed.
And you have time to look around at the crowd and notice people and see things.
And obviously, you know, like in the same way that a great batsman will have his purple patches and have the periods where he's out of form and everything, no comic hits that every single time.
No.
But I love the feeling both of, when I get to be that person, it's exhilarating. And also because I know what that feeling feels like whenever I'm watching someone and I'm conscious of the fact that I'm a part of that happening in the room, that's absolutely exhilarating as well. Just being able to watch the stage and be like, you are playing us like a fucking fiddle right now, and I love it. And you can't let anyone know until you come off that how good it feels, but you are going to be absolutely buzzing.
Brilliant. Yeah. Do you get that thrill also if you're in the midst of that, and that's something that you would have done before, practiced in front of audiences, so you've in a way worked the material, and then suddenly in one situation when everything's flying, another thought occurs to you.
Yes, and it's all the more satisfying when you're doing that and there's something that you just offhandedly say and you're like, oh, that's what makes it click. That's the keystone for this entire thing.
Yes.
And I found it, and how good is that?
So I finally built this whole routine into something that is complete.
And that's lovely. And sometimes that can take ages. Like, there was something that sort of routine about depression that I had written and wanted to put in my 2015 show, and I was working on with my director, but we just realized that fundamentally that the shape of this show did not accommodate this thing. But I was like, oh, there's something in this. There's something in this, if I could just find it. And then 3 years later in the 2018 show, realized that there's a period where, oh, what exists already slots perfectly in here. And it's so clear out of the context of the rest of this show, the 2018 show, how I make the bit properly sing and properly work. And that, you know, the delayed gratification of 3 years when I finally got there was wonderful.
I'm sure. And in fact, that thing almost of putting it aside and letting it breathe, letting it grow.
Yeah, I put that in the cellar.
Let the idea... Yes, that often happens. If you're writing a whole comedy show, I worked for a while as a script editor. And one of the great problems that people often have with writing comedy is that there may be something that is clearly extremely funny in itself, but doesn't fit within the context of the show.
Yeah.
And that's the thing that you say, I'm afraid that's the bit that has to go. And they say, but it's really funny. And you say, it is funny, but it makes everything else less funny.
Yeah. I think it was Paul Byrne who was telling me the story. He's a comedy director. And he was talking with Andrew Maxwell and Ed Byrne, both comedians, and Ed and Paul are brothers. And there was something that just like came out of conversation that either Ed or Andrew had said as a bit. And the other one was like, oh, yeah, but you could never say that on stage. And Paul just said, no, you couldn't say that on stage. In his voice, it makes perfect sense,
yes.
Which is a really good insight.
Yeah, do you feel that there's an area of the world that comedy is banned from, as it were? Or do you feel that it's the joke that's important? I think David Baddiel was saying this. He was saying that he feels that as long as the joke is good, then it doesn't matter what the subject matter is.
Yeah, I think, well, I was take as my credo Lenny Bruce's assertion that the job of a stand-up comedian is to make an audience laugh once every 15 seconds. And it's like, that's a bit, because yes, that's all you need to do. And then the means whereby you pursue that end are entirely up to you. There's a huge difference between can't and should think better of, there's got to be some middle ground between I get to be a dick for the sake of being a dick and, oh, we're going to be incredibly censorious and the fact that you have mentioned this sacred cow means that you are now beyond the pale.
Yeah.
And I think that the middle ground there is the fundamental thing that everyone's or most people's parents or teachers will have told them when they were children, which is manners cost nothing. Right?
So it's important if you're going to do jokes in those areas to make sure that you know what you're doing. You're not just being flippant.
Yeah, exactly. Like, and when I, you know, there's a huge difference between watching someone who you know is being, in inverted commas, edgy for the sake of edgy and trying to get a rise out of people. And that's not a comedian, that's a pub bore, right? And there's a huge difference between that and watching someone who is very good, like watching someone like Dave Chappelle, who is at the absolute top of their game and is like, do you know what? I'm going to have a go at some topics that you may think one shouldn't discuss or what, but I have thought about this and I'm not just doing it to be, as you say, flippant or anything like that, but I'm doing it because what comedy should be about is exploring things and exploring them comically, but exploring them seriously.
Yes. Often by exploring them in a comic way, you're making a very serious point, I think.
Yeah, and it's the beauty of, like, jokes are a zip file for a huge amount of information, right? You laugh because you get it, and then you're unpacking everything in your head. It's beautiful.
And also, it's very helpful for people who feel that they may be stuck in an area in a solitary way, that actually they're the only person who has a problem with this thing or it's difficult for them. And to hear somebody talk about an area of their life that is similar can really release people, I think.
Oh, that's how I felt... in a way, talking about mental health has been very good for that on stage. And also, like, remember in the 2018 show largely revolved around that trip that I took to India where at the end of it I spent time with my grandmother at the end of her life. And she at the time was... she died of breast cancer but had very advanced dementia as well, and it was just awful to see this person who I could only ever remember as being this powerhouse of sort of grace and love and compassion and intelligence and ferocity sort of reduced to that state at the end of things. And I, while there, actively considered euthanizing her when I was alone with her because she had in her more lucid moments, she had expressed a sincere wish to die and to be put out of it all. And I couldn't do it. in the end, like I sat like really intensely like weighing it all up and couldn't bring myself to do it. Mm. And when I was going to talk about that on stage at the Commonwealth, that was one of the things that I was very afraid of discussing, because I'm like, but that's awful, isn't it? That what sort of person actively could consider killing someone who they love in that way? And my director was just like, you'd be surprised. And as a result of talking about that on stage, I have lost count of the number of people who told me after the show that my mother or father or my grandmother or grandfather was in a similar position, and I went through exactly the same thought process and I couldn't do it either.
Yes.
And it really changed me and changed how I thought of myself and thought about a lot of things. And I felt like that was just a position that I felt so alone in before. And then telling people about it, I was like, oh God, this is so common, it's almost mundane, right? But it's so horrible that no one will want to talk about it.
So you feel as if you must be the only person who's ever gone through that.
Yeah.
But I think almost anybody who's sat with somebody that they love, who's near the end of their life, and their life is either just full of pain or just full of frustration and misery, and have had that person they love say to them, God, I wish this would end.
Yeah.
We've all had that debate.
And to be in that situation where you're like, I have the power to make this stop, and I feel actively selfish that I am not, I am choosing, I'm making an active choice not to do that, because like inaction is also a choice.
Yes.
It's a very, very strange feeling.
Mm.
And I love that you can talk about that in, like, what's it? I talked about that in stand up. Have you ever discovered the one thing that you wouldn't do for someone you'd do anything for? I felt like the meatloaf of euthanasia. and just being able to puncture like that massive tension with something so daft was really nice.
I'd do anything. Yeah. I won't do.
Yeah.
Very good. Oh, dear. Has anybody ever had the courage to come up, or in fact, maybe the stupidity to come up and say, yes, I was in that situation and I did do it?
No, but I would really admire them.
Yeah. It would be amazing, wouldn't
it? Yeah. But it's also the thing, like, I wouldn't judge that person. Like, I wouldn't negatively judge that person.
Even ask them, how were they so brave?
Yeah. And that's, like, had I not been in that position myself, I don't know how I would react to someone telling me that sort of thing. I think I'd still probably be fine with it, because I could be like, well, I can sort of theoretically empathize with the situation and I can understand why that would be something that you'd do. But yeah, after it, I would just be like, yep, no moral judgments here, mate.
No. So are you in favor then of euthanasia?
Yeah.
Yes.
Wholeheartedly, because I think that there are, as with everything, going to be grey areas, but there are certain situations where everything is so clearly black and white. Mm-hmm. This is a human being, like the capacity for human pleasure and joy in this person has now gone, and all we are doing is extending pain.
Yes,
that I think. Like, it's just like, it's not like someone who's got a bit dotty and the family are pushing a pen into their hand to sign a will and everything, where you're like, oh no, I'm not 100% sure about that.
It's perfectly possible to regulate those things, surely.
Yeah, what's really horrible about it is that when it is something that's neurologically degenerative, obviously, like, if you don't have that, but you have some other kind of terminal condition, but you're still compos mentis, you can book the plane ticket to Switzerland, go out, dignitas, do it your way, and everything. But if you have lost what I think is the most important part of being a human being, which is just the fundamental fact of who you are, then you're not allowed to make that decision, because, you know, in the moments that you're capable enough to ask for it, you're never going to be able to understand T's and C's.
Yes, you should have foreseen this. Yeah. You should have written it down when you were compass mentis. Yeah. But now, I'm terribly sorry.
Yeah.
And that seems unfair, doesn't it? Because everybody around them who loves them says, no, this is the thing they would have wanted. Mm. We know they would have wanted, even though now they're unable to tell us.
Yeah, so I suppose maybe you've got to write it down beforehand, before it happens.
Maybe. Well, there we are. I don't know how we came down that route, but it's very interesting. And I have to say I agree with you, because all my experience of seeing friends or loved ones in those situations, I think it would have only been a blessing.
Yeah.
I think it's interesting to go down that sort of dark route on those subjects, because it is possible for humour to come out of those. My aunt, who was 90-something, I went to see her. She had dementia. And she said to me, I don't know. She said, I'm 84 now. And I said, how old are you? She said, I'm 84. And I said, actually, you're 97. And she went, didn't time fly?
That's excellent.
So, in fact, there's always humour.
That's
in
really
the most
great.
Awful situation. So we're going to take that humour and let it fly on stage for you. You're
yes.
completely in control, which is a marvellous thing, and it goes into the time capsule.
Yeah. And then the fourth thing that I'm putting in, I think is in some ways a slight cheat, because everything that I've put in thus far has been this, in a way. But I want to put in those brief moments of whole, all-encompassing love that you've, you know, and you are in a way that is what the smell of my mother's kitchen evokes to me. That is what
being
sitting opposite
girlfriend.
Someone in Mexico City involves. It is what doing the job that I love in the way that I love the most, doing it, that's what that is as well. And it's what being in India at 20 years old and just sitting with my grandmother as she read the newspaper and me just like stroking the skin on her arm, because she used to be quite big and then lost her weight, so she's got all this excess skin, and so it was just the softest thing that has ever existed in the world. And it's those moments. It's standing on a street in Cambridge at the age of 24 and experiencing a kiss that made it feel like there were film cameras rotating around us. It is standing outside a bar on Middlesex Street near my girlfriend's work and her looking at me and telling me that she loved me for the first time in November. It's all of those sorts of moments of, like, yeah, just fully immersive love, be it romantic, familial, any sort.
Mm, and know. Friends.
Yeah.
Yes. They are glorious moments, aren't they? They're few and far between, I think, strangely. You go through life feeling reasonably content with most things, but those moments where you realise, oh, my word, this is just perfect, are few and far between. They're well worth grabbing together and treasuring. Mm.
There's a fantastic book called Some 40 Tales of the Afterlife, where the author, who's, I think it's David Eagleman, I always fudge his surname, but he wrote sort of, there are 40 very short stories of when you die, this is what happens. And they're all just like nice little philosophical thought experiments and everything, and all really, really lovely and worthwhile to read for anyone who's listening, and indeed for you if you've not read it. But the first one in that book is when you die, you experience all of your life again, but all moments from the same category are lumped together. And it's like, so some of it is very frustrating. Like, you spend hours and hours just swallowing and everything, and you spend days in the shower, you spend 30 years asleep.
You spend 2 weeks with your eyes shut blinking.
And, you know, there are times, like, you know, the time that you spend crying, and, you know, one of them is, like, lumping together all of the most pure forms of happiness, and it's only, like, 7 minutes or something like that, but it's like, But yeah, it's those moments collated, and you just sort of hope that they're peppered enough in life to see you through to the next one. You know, it's like an animal that's gliding and trying to catch the next little bit of wind to ride.
Yes, and you've not got any children.
No,
so you've not.
I've got those ones. Yeah,
you know, and that's a very strange thing, because it's not only is there this extraordinary moment where you realise that actually, without reservation, you adore your child. And that happens quite early on. For some people, it takes quite a while. It may take a year. For me, it happened fairly quickly, almost the moment I held my child. And I realised that it was unreserved love.
Yeah.
And it was far more important than me. But at the same time, that's mixed in with this complete terror.
Yeah.
I am now responsible for this thing that I adore. Oh, my God.
I once... I remember once talking to my father about this, and I was like, surely, you know, like, my sister, I've got an older sister, very successful career, she's married, has a house, it's all going nicely for her. I was like, well, Dad, you must think, like, you know, Nidhi is doing so well in that thing, like, I'm doing a thing that I really love, and I'm doing all right with that, and there's at least some sense of stability in that now. And so, surely, like, do you ever take a moment and you, like, step back and be like, oh, that's a bit of a load off, actually. Like, it's not like I'm worrying about them in the same way as, you know, they're 16 and why aren't they home yet, and that sort of thing. And he's just like, no, still worry every day at the fact that that's just going to happen regardless. And, like, I love the idea that, you know, my grandparents, even when they had children who were in their 50s and 60s and stuff, were still like, oh, God, is Vikram eating properly? And it's like he's 60-something year old man. Like,
you're virtually the same age.
Yeah, he's fine.
Charlie, mate. You're so old, it doesn't make any difference.
Yeah.
I know. Well, I still say to my children who are in their 30s, you know, almost 40, my daughter, when she leaves the house, I still say, mind the road. And she looks at me as if I'm a moron. But I couldn't bear the idea of not saying it.
Yeah.
Just being careful. I just want to just put that thought in her mind.
Yes.
So, yes, that feeling of responsibility never goes away.
Yeah.
We all have those moments in life, that moment of astonishing joy.
Yeah, it's that sort of swell just right in the middle. Whenever I feel those things, I always think how much it makes sense that before more contemporary medicine, it, like, absolutely makes sense why everyone thought that the heart and the stomach was the root of everything.
And that
like the brain was just a weird thing that was sort of there and, like, might do something, but it's, you never the feeling is never in there.
No.
It's always in the middle of you, in the core.
Yes.
Vibrating outwards.
Yes. And all the descriptions of those moments involve that, don't they? Stomach churning, heartbreaking, a gut reaction.
Mm. Yeah, for sure. So those are something worth preserving, I think.
I won't look at them individually because I think that would be to pry.
Yeah.
But I will let you take those moments and put them in the time capsule.
Right.
Well, we're very nearly there, which is a shame. I'm enjoying this chat. So you have one item left, and I'm afraid this has to be something that you haven't enjoyed.
Yeah.
But you will be getting rid of it. This you can lock
so
away.
So this is the one that just gets buried.
Just get buried. This is gone.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if it's wise to just wholly bury anything that you don't particularly like, because most of the things that you don't particularly like or regret or what have you are things that you can grow from. And so it would have to be something relatively mundane. I'll tell you what I want to get rid of. And it's a facet of my character that I would love to be shot of. And it's knowing desperately that there's something important that I have to do and not doing it, but spending the entire time that I'm not doing it just being in my head, oh, isn't it bad that I'm not doing that thing that's really important? It's just fucking do it then. Like, come on, how hard can it consume? And then you do it and it's always fine.
And it takes minutes.
Yeah.
It's so simple. Yes. But I think everybody can identify with that.
Yeah. But I think it's somehow, it's deeper than procrastination. Because it's procrastination with a side of self-induced guilt. And it's all totally unnecessary. And yet, I think, universally human. So yeah, I would love for that to be buried in the mantle of the earth.
And yet, I know so few people, and I do know some, but I know very few people who actually, when a thing needs to be done, they just do it.
Mm.
Hardly anybody behaves that way.
Oh, absolutely. And it's like whenever I, you know, hear interviews with writers or comedians or anything where they're discussing their process, in inverted commas, and every time I hear someone describe their process, I just think, you are a fucking liar. Absolutely, 100%, everything that has just come out of your mouth is false. Because, we are not the same person, but we are not sufficiently dissimilar that you actually do the things that you're claiming that you do.
Yeah. When you're supposed to do them. Yeah. Get out of here. Yeah. I do have a friend who does that, but in fact, he has the opposite frustration in as much as everybody else annoys him. Because he's always saying to people, great, so you've just emailed it to me.
Yeah.
And then it doesn't come. And he writes and says, I thought you were going to email the thing to me. And they say, yeah, I will. Well, just do it then.
Yeah, it takes seconds.
Bear people procrastinating.
Yeah. Oh, I would hate to be that guy.
Yeah.
It's why it's always better to be the person who's slightly late for everything than the person who's slightly early for everything. Well, the latter that's... person is far more frustrated.
No, I'm a person who's early, so I...
Oh, no, I'm aware of this. This is why I'm wearing a dinosaur onesie when you turned up to my flat. Everything. This is like 20 past 11 and I'm still lying in bed. And I'm like, well, surely Michael said 11:30.
About one.
Yeah.
Well, yes, I've never interviewed anybody in a dinosaur onesie. So I think it's had just... The listeners don't know, but for me, there's been this tiny little frisson. Yeah, we are going to put that in there. But you may regret it, so I'm not going to bury it. You can go and get it back when you suddenly realise, actually, I like procrastinating.
Do you know, I would love to have it, I say when, is actually an if, I retire. I think that would be a very useful thing. Yeah, so I would like for that to be buried and it to be in a lockbox, the location in a lockbox and everything. And that's put in a safety deposit Swiss vault or something somewhere with express instructions to my lawyers. In this, I have lawyers. Why not? That it's only when I retire should I be given the right. And then I can go find it. I can go on a quest. I can dig it up. And then... You know, it's in pill form. Yeah. Nick Cage and
Nick Cage about to come in.
Yeah.
It always does.
He says yes to stuff. yeah. They've reduced it into pill form. And finally, I dig up this from Treasure Island. I dig up this thing and I pop the pill, have it with a glug of water. And then from my retirement until I die, I am the world's leading expert at doing fuck all.
The terrible thing would be if you got to that moment and thought, oh, I'll pop the pill later. No, I've still got it. I'm cursed. It never left me. Aya, thank you so much for taking
time. My pleasure.
It's been lovely to talk to you.
You have been listening to My Time Capsule with me, Mike Fenton-Stevens, and my guest, Ahir Shah. You can subscribe to this podcast on Acast, Spotify, or Apple Podcasts, or the provider of your own choosing, to hear all other episodes and to receive each new episode on the day of release. And if you have the time, we'd love it if you would rate us and leave a review. Thanks. You can follow us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at MyTCPod or at Fenton Stevens. This podcast was produced by John Fenton Stevens, and the music is by Past the Peas Music. It was a cast-off production. Thank you for listening. And if you've enjoyed listening to it half as much as I've enjoyed recording it, then, well, I've enjoyed recording it twice as much as you've enjoyed listening to it. I mean, that's just maths. Bye.
Mom. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market. Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.